This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. It is Reporters Roundtable Thursday, which means that we have reporters from Northwest Indiana Media to talk about the stories that they covered in print as well as online this week. And this week we feature Joseph Pete, who's the business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, and his Statehouse colleague, Dan Carden, will be with us as well, too, to talk about some of the interesting things that came out of the Indianapolis legislative session recently and some other items as well, too. This is Regionally Speaking's Reporter Roundtable Thursday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and let's check in here with Joseph Pete, who is the business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Joseph, thanks once again for joining us here on the program today.
Oh, happy to be here, Chris.
Well, let's start out first talking about the most important thing coming up as far as this week is concerned. NIPSCO is working on a big report that they have to turn in to the state utility regulators, and they're looking for public input, and I think one of these public sessions is coming up Friday, tomorrow.
Yes, they are working on their integrated resource plan. It's a 20-year plan for the future that they're required to turn into the Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission every 2 years. It is a non-binding plan, but it can be kind of important. Last time they determined that they were going to phase off some of their coal power, including the Bailey Electric Generating Station. They're in the process of decommissioning that currently. Mm-hmm. It will be taken down and completely decommissioned by May of this year. So it's a very important plan that looks at like the mix of energy sources that they're using as they go forward into the future. There is some public interest in the plan this year. NIPSCO says that they are, last planning process, they determined they'd retire 50% of their coal-fired electric generation, and this year they're looking at providing affordable, clean energy while maintaining flexibility for future technology and market changes. Mm-hmm. And then I know there are some groups, like environmental groups, that are particularly interested in the process this year and kind of encouraging them to, decommission more of the coal, start to look more toward renewables as a long-term solution that will result in fewer emissions and less pollution.
I know you quote in your story somebody who works with the Sierra Club as being concerned. They'd like to know more about what's in this this plan, which, as you say, it comes out every so often, and the latest one is due by the end of the year, I think, to be turned in.
Yes, absolutely. They're planning a series of 5 public meetings, and they'll have to turn something in by, I believe it's December 2nd, but NIPSCO is looking to have it in earlier in the fall, if at all possible. It's the kind of planning these utilities do ongoing. It's a very heavily regulated industry. Any kind of investments they make have to be approved by the state if they want to recoup it through rates. You've seen trends nationally where people have been moving away from coal. Often it is to natural gas because the natural gas has been substantially cheaper over the past several years. There's been a boom of production in this country. Utilities across the nation have been turning into it more just because it's more cost-effective than coal. Typically, the Sierra Club and some other groups would prefer, wind and solar and even more, getting away from fossil fuels altogether. But NIPSCO is... they're going to be looking at a number of considerations. One is the public input. The other, what there's good for their business, the bottom line, and delivering returns to their shareholders.
That's right. Well, we've got some pretty big users of electricity, as we know, with the steel mills and BP among them. So they're probably keeping a close eye to see what this annual report or this biennial report's going to cover as well too. One of the other interesting stories, Joseph, that's in the in the Times is a story that probably most people don't even think of. It kind of flies under the radar, but I'm sure that the president's talk about the tariffs that he is proposing to impose around the world, and even though there may not be any tariffs in Canada against Canada or Mexico, but still I'm sure it's going to come up, is the issue about newsprint. Of course, it's very much used with newspapers these days and other publications, and there's a question about what kind of impact that the Canadian newsprint market may make on the United States, and I'm sure here in Northwest Indiana in particular. Tell us about that, please.
Yes. Well, as a steel reporter, I've covered tariffs for years, and I'm just kind of surprised at all the attention they've been getting lately. They're being handled a little bit. Usually it's a little more off the radar. Now it's kind of like front and center with the president like directly interjecting himself into the process. Mm-hmm. Like the steel tariffs have obviously helped the local steel industry here. But, you know, we've had over 400 tariffs in place previously, including 200 nearly on steel-related products, and they never previously got like this much attention. But that's changed. One of the areas that hasn't been as noted is that the U.S. Department of Commerce approved preliminary tariffs on uncoated groundwood paper from Canada this year. And this is a little bit different than steel and some of the other tariffs that are traditionally imposed because there's only one company in the U.S. that has been lobbying for these, and there's only one that is substantively producing this type of paper anymore in Washington State. It is the North Pacific Paper Company, and it does have some operations and outside of Washington and Georgia and Mississippi and so on. But usually this is like, you know, six or seven steelmakers are lobbying for tariffs. In this case, it's strictly one company. Almost all of the newsprint is being imported from the forests in Canada at this point for various economic reasons. And there's been the newspaper industry, publishers, paper producers, they banded together to form a coalition called Stop Tariffs on Printers on Publishers to try and stave off these tariffs of up to 32%. They're warning it could greatly raise production costs. It could put some newspapers, especially in rural areas, out of business entirely. It's the second biggest cost that most papers face after labor is on newsprint. They're warning this could result in, you know, layoffs across the country. It's already a struggling industry that's, you know, and then it's usually the main source of local, you know, news in a community. It has the most resources to, you know, to be able to report on local stories. And they're warning that these tariffs could greatly jeopardize that. And in most cases, you know, tariffs would be protecting American jobs. But the newspapers are arguing in this case, it's basically one company that's trying to be able to charge more and pad its profits, and that it's kind of manipulating the tariff system for its own financial gain, and it's potentially jeopardizing up to 600,000 jobs in publishing and newspapers across the country.
And I think people probably don't realize, too, that that besides newspapers, the daily papers and the weekly papers that need the newsprint, there are commercial printers out there. All those Strack and Van Til ads that you happen to see stuffed in your local paper, they have to be print on newsprint, and that has to be done locally or regionally anyway. And the companies that produce those for the various clients they have, they're paying a lot for newsprint too. So there are a lot of other organizations other than just the newspapers themselves that are keeping a very close eye on this, I imagine.
Oh, absolutely, yes. You have a lot of the printers around here, like Misprint and Hammond and so on, that would be, you know, potentially affected by this. It'll affect book publishing. Hasn't been they haven't been as hard hit as newspapers, but, you know, they've had their own struggles over the years. There's questions of whether people are going to turn more to e-books. You know, this is going to drive up their costs. It'll go on to affect booksellers and have a ripple effect through everybody. You also have a lot of like small free weeklies, like especially Northwest Indiana. You see like Senior Life and you know, Generations, and a lot of these like smaller 411. A lot of these smaller free publications that can't be really operating at a very high, you know, profit margin. They're just kind of community newspapers trying to get, you know, community news out to readers, and it's not like they're raking in money hand over fist. And this would potentially, you know, substantially drive up their operating costs, and pretty much only one company in Washington would, you know, benefit.
Yeah. One of the other stories that you had too, Joseph Pete, that we're talking about today here on Regionally Speaking, is an interesting story about, I guess, looking to the future after Star Plaza, or maybe you can say the Star Plaza office complex, because it's not only the Radisson Hotel, which is no longer there and soon to be torn down, the Star Plaza Theater itself, but also the Twin Towers. It's all in that same big patch of property there on US 30 and I-65 there in Merrillville. What's to come about that?
Yes, White Lodging has been working on a redevelopment project for that entire quadrant. They're planning on basically tearing everything down. There's questions as to, you know, how big it's going to be. They are talking about a lot of like green space. They have mentioned a hotel. you know, going in at that location. But it remains to be seen, like, what exactly will be built. They have torn down the Radisson and the Conference Center. They have closed the Star Plaza, and it's supposed to be torn down starting this spring. Mm-hmm. And then they're in the process of, like, winding down the Twin Towers, which has been ongoing for a while. Even before the closure was announced, we had been hearing rumblings because they had been not renewing leases at the building to kind of result in an orderly transition. And that affects, you know, like 2-3 dozen different corporate client, you know, corporations, banks, insurance agencies, dentists, law firms. That had been a big hub for white-collar professionals in the region. It was, in fact, the largest single office property, not the tallest, but between the two. But the closing has really displaced displaced dozens of tenants. Most have been deciding to stay in Tamaraville. They found space in other buildings nearby, like Park Tower, 8585 Broadway. Some of the office buildings are the ones just a couple, you know, within short walking distance, like the building where Montesol is, just down the street from there.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But in some cases, in the case of Fifth Third Bank, which had been one of the major tenants there, they've just decided, instead of picking a new headquarters like that, they're going to absorb all the functions into their existing bank branches. Mm-hmm. They also own like a 3- or 4-story building in downtown Valpo, where they moved a lot of it. So that, you know, their presence in Maryville is pretty much, entirely gone at this point. They're consolidated everything either in Valpo or at the branches. But a lot of the others have kind of, chosen to stuck to the area. But it's a time when the office market is particularly tight in Northwest Indiana. Across suburban Chicagoland, you have like 20% vacancy rate in offices. In Northwest Indiana, it's been more like 14%. And it's tightening with this especially, and you started to see new construction of offices. There was the new one they built in Oxbow Landing in there was a new office constructed in Oxbow Landing off the Borman in Hammond. Mm-hmm. There's the new Cardinal campus, which will have a bunch of 2-story office buildings going up in Highland. They're building a new building for the IRS, the local IRS headquarters, and Legacy Foundation near Park Tower in Maryville. That's been going up, so you're starting to see, obviously, Northwest Indiana, we're known a little bit more for our factories and manufacturing than we are for, but this is a kind of a, there is a hub, especially in Maryville, of like white-collar jobs. You have a lot of companies with, you know, footprints there, some big national corporations too, like Lockheed Martin, Xerox, companies of that nature, and the region is kind of adjusting to the loss of the largest office tower to kind of be able to accommodate them. So you're starting to see some new office capacity going online across the region.
Okay. Now, finally, Joseph, here we had another story here talking, I guess, along the same lines about real estate and some expansion. There's one of the biggest office towers in the region is getting some assistance here from a company that has decided that they want to be able to do some overhauling, I guess, to bring in more clients there. Tell us what Napleton Auto Group is very interested in doing and where this property is located.
Yes, they own 8585 Broadway, which is at 8585 Broadway. A lot of people know it as the Chase Tower. Mm-hmm. It is. It's a big white building with a 9-story white building with the Chase printed on the side. But originally, it had been the Gary National Bank building back when it was built in the 70s. And then, you know, Gary National Bank changed its name to Gainer Bank. It got bought out by a long series of banks. It was bought out by like NBD, Bank One, Chase, and when it was originally like entirely filled with bankers, but Chase is pretty much now just has the one branch on the first floor. It's been a multi-tenant office building for some time. They had a commercial lending department in there, but they had moved that to Valpo a couple years ago. It's hosted some other tenants like Corinthian Colleges, which then became Everest College, Direct Buy, which is headquartered across the street, used to rent out an entire floor. But it was built in the 70s. And it's kind of, buildings age, buildings get, older, and especially with offices, there's a push for, like, Class A office space. A lot of the, like, white-collar users, like a new tenant in there is Wells Fargo Wealth Advisors. You know, they want to be able to have, like, a nice building where if they're going to have, like, the well-to-do clients, you know, coming in. And that is why 8585 Broadway and Napleton have been investing significantly in an overhaul, basically the first major overhaul for the building. They've already pumped more than $2 million into it. They've completely redone, you know, they're replacing replacing all the windows. They're replacing the roof, all the building mechanicals. The lobby is like, it looks like something you'd see in The Loop. They put in like, you know, very slick art. They're going to put in like they're displaying the work. They're going to make the lobby effectively like an art gallery, showing the work of like local artists. They put in all new furniture, revive the cafeteria. They're replacing windows, and they've been just pouring money into the building left and right, and they've been able to attract a number of new tenants, including some from the Twin Towers. Hoppner, Wagner, and Evans, the law firm that had its name on the Twin Towers, is not signed a lease and moving into the 8585 Broadway, but they've also managed to be able to bring in like Wells Fargo Wealth Advisors, Xerox, a bunch of new tenants that had not been in there previously. The occupancy had fallen below 50%, and it was like, it is the biggest office tower, individual office tower in the area, but they're hoping that with a bunch of improvements, they'll be able to bring in more of these tenants like Managed Health Services and Allstate, and so far they're being successful. They've got a number of plans for the building, though, in addition. Like, they're talking on the first floor about trying to potentially bring in like a really high caliber restaurant that would be in part of the lobby, like something like a Ciao Bella or a Gamba Ristorante, where, you know, it's right off of Broadway in a heavily trafficked area, so it could serve people in the street, but then also give like the office tenants an option for dining and for entertaining their clients there. They built in a new conference center in the building where it can seat up to like 100 people, and the tenants can rent it for like day-long conferences and so forth. But they've been just making improvements left or right. It is a pretty impressive building. You can go up to the top and see the Chicago skyline from up there.
That's great. Well, it sounds like it's a great expansion, and certainly at a time we would say we're kind of following through like we mentioned earlier about the loss of the Twin Towers coming up and other things too happening in Merivale. And we thank you very much, Joseph Pete from The Times, who covers business news for the newspaper online as well as in print.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
Continuing on with Regionally Speaking's Reporters Roundtable Thursday, let's check in with Dan Carton, who has been covering the General Assembly and other issues in Indianapolis for The Times of Northwest Indiana. And as always, Dan, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Well, let's take here a look at the impact of the measures that made it or maybe didn't make it, might be a better way to put it, after the chaos of the closing of this last legislative session.
Yeah, it was really kind of an unusual end to what had otherwise been a pretty tranquil session this year. Basically, they just ran out of time. The General Assembly is required to adjourn for the year by midnight on March 14th. And there are about a half dozen legislative proposals still pending that the House hadn't gotten around to voting on yet for a bunch of different reasons, but they automatically died at midnight. So included in there was House Bill 1315, which would have reduced the power of the Gary School Trustees. They already don't have any power. The district is run by a state-appointed emergency manager. But this would have limited how often they could meet and made some other changes to kind of further diminish their role. So that did not go through, and it doesn't look like that's going to come back up in the special session that the governor intends to call.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't on the governor's list of priorities, and I haven't heard anybody else really talking about that. So, you know, it all depends on what gets filed in May, but it looks like the Gary School Board is going to at least retain some relevance going forward. Another measure that didn't go through was this bill providing for three new alcohol permits in Munster, the Centennial Village development that they're building on Calumet Avenue. It's supposed to be kind of a new downtown, is going to have a bunch of restaurants, and Munster is at its alcohol permit cap based on its population. So this would have given Munster three new alcohol permits to be used just in that development that didn't go through. And I know they're still building parts of it, so, I mean, that might be able to wait until next year.
Yeah.
Or it could get slipped into some of the tax measures that lawmakers are planning to consider during the special session. Ed Saliday, Valparaiso Republican, was the sponsor of the autonomous vehicle regulations. That also faltered at the end of session, didn't go through. So you won't be seeing any self-driving cars on the roads of Indiana at least until next year.
Now, I know for sure that with the governor calling for whenever it happens to be, they haven't set the date yet to be sure, but they're planning for a special session. And we know you talked about here about the measure that they didn't make it through involving the Gary Community School Board. And I know that apparently is one of the areas that was taken out of the plans, at least I know, for bringing the issue back up again here in the special session. But they're focusing pretty much on Muncie, aren't they, on the school district there?
They are, yeah. The Muncie School District is kind of in a similar situation as Gary was last year. The district needs about a $12 million loan to meet its operating expenses because they've lost student population. And as you know, in Indiana, money follows the child.
Right.
So when kids leave the district loses the money, and sometimes they can't cut the programs as quickly as the kids leave. So there is an intent to do something for Muncie. Originally, Ball State University was going to become kind of their emergency manager. The university
right.
was going to run the local elementary or the local public schools. I'm hearing that Ball State is going to pull out of that because the legislation didn't go through. So I'm not sure what's going to happen with Muncie going forward. And again, nobody's talking about putting Gary in this bill, but Gary's stuff was in the earlier proposal that died.
Right.
And legislative leaders have said that they're willing to consider the stuff that was kind of on the table when the clock struck 12. So it could come back up.
Well, stay tuned, as they like
exactly.
to say on this one, for sure. One of the other interesting stories was a story, I guess, and poignant in a way. We're talking about some veteran Hoosier lawmakers from Northwest Indiana who decided not to run for re-election, and they, in turn, had their last legislative session. And here, with this bit of chaos, I guess, tell us from your article that was online and in print here about Charlie Brown and Linda Lawson and Scott Pelath, and they're the lawmakers we're referring to, and what you had to say to them about them, I guess, a rather bittersweet moment, I suppose, when they finally did the signee die.
Yeah, the House does a really neat thing where they kind of pay tribute to all the legislators that they know aren't coming back. I mean, there's going to be more who don't come back just because of people who lose in the election, but people who are retiring, like Linda Lawson is, or just sort of stepping aside, like Scott Pelath is. Charlie Brown is running for the Lake County Council, so he may still be in government next year. But they spend some time and let all the members come up and talk about what the legislators have meant to the body, to the state. And these three in particular have all served in the General Assembly for a long time. Charlie Brown was there for 36 years. Linda Lawson and Scott Pelath both served 20 years. And, you know, even though the Democrats have been in the minority for a lot of those years, each of those lawmakers had made a big impact on the state. Charlie Brown helped create the Healthy Indiana Plan. He legalized casino gaming in Gary. Scott Pelath has done a lot with environmental issues. Linda Lawson has been a champion for women's issues. In law enforcement, she's a former Hammond police captain, the first female police officer in Hammond. So they've all been extremely involved in the state's history over the last quarter century and beyond. And a lot of their colleagues, you know, wanted to recognize them for that.
And I suppose, too, this we're talking also, too, I guess, a certain amount of loss, in this case, of legislative and professional expertise, if anything, institutional memory, so to speak.
Yeah, and it's a big loss for Northwest Indiana. You know, they've all represented the region for a number of years, and, you know, combined with Earl Harris's death a few years ago, Sulansky's death a few years ago, we're sort of in this cycle of replacing these, you know, region institutions at the State House with new members. And, you know, I'll say, you know, Eddie Melton in the Senate, who replaced Earlene Rogers,
right,
is doing a great job. Earl Harris Jr. is doing a great job. But, you know, if you've only been there 2 years, you're still often just figuring out how things work as opposed to necessarily getting things done.
Well, so you're probably still trying to figure out the building itself. The State House is not an easy place to traverse here. If you're not familiar with it, you'll end up in the basement with the media if you're not careful. You take the wrong turn someplace. I know. One of the other stories I know that is really a developing story right now is what Governor Eric Holcomb will officially sign into law. He's had a number of the measures already at his desk after the legislature acted on them.
Yeah, and I've been sort of doing a daily or every other day story on the stuff that's moving through.
Besides the workforce development measures that obviously the governor's taken advantage of signing as well, too, are there any others that you see coming up here that you'll be having in your stories ahead here talking about what the governor's done?
Well, you know, probably the most important measure of the session, the firefly becoming the state's insect, is going to get signed into law on Friday.
Certainly, the most transitory of the bunch here too. We're talking about an insect, folks.
The state insect.
No less state insect. Well, these are interesting, and they're interesting points as counterpoints, aren't they? To all the serious things that get talked about. These are fun measures that lawmakers I know like to be able to handle and put out there, and for the governor to sign too. It makes you feel more human, I would imagine.
Yeah. I mean, and it reminds you, too, that, you know, for all the hard work that the General Assembly does on big issues, you think back to last year when they passed the tax increase to fund the road construction.
Yeah.
There's going to be a ton of road construction. The governor was talking about this, $100 million a month, you know, every month till the end of time is going to be led by NDOT. And, you know, that's going to transform the state. But, you know, everybody has their issues, and the school in Lafayette wanted to get the state insect, and it took them a few years to get there, and now we're going to have a state insect. So,
well, that's what you said, something very good for persistence, to be persistent and keep at it and not be discouraged when it doesn't come up in a session. There's always next year.
Exactly.
Dan Carton is the State House correspondent for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And as always, Dan, thank you for spending time with us to talk about this on Regionally Speaking.
Anytime.
And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Once again, it's time for the Valparaiso University annual Soup Bowls for the Hungry fundraiser. It's going to happen on the campus. And to talk about it, we have, of all people, a ceramics instructor. Michelle Carrazzo is one of the people who are key in beginning this program going and making it the success that it has been. And it's a good reason why ceramics are involved in helping feed the hungry. And Michelle, thank you for being with us on Regionally Speaking.
You're welcome.
Well, tell us the importance, first off, I guess it should be obvious, but maybe not, why it's important to use bowls or soup bowls in particular to feed the hungry.
It's more a metaphor. You know, the national program is called the Empty Bowl Project, and it was started, it's just a loose collection of potters who decided to use their skills to, you know, help usually nonprofits or any organization they want. The bowl becomes a metaphor for feeding the hungry. We're all very excited about it, and the whole art department participates now. So there's all sorts of art, you know, from photography to drawings, and the teachers contribute also.
Now, we know that this involves soup bowls, and we're talking here in this case actually creative and unique soup bowls, an art that's created by the Valpo students and staff that'll be up for bid for the project. But there's a proceeds that's definitely going to benefit locally for this. Tell us about the group that's going to be the most beneficiary of the project.
This year, the name of it is Project Neighbors.
And do you know much about this organization? What do they do here in Northwest Indiana and in the Valparaiso area in particular?
Very interesting. I was quite surprised when I read about them. They are kind of a vehicle to help all sorts of organizations from that need help.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be channeling eyeglasses somewhere, or building projects, or any food banks. Things like that.
I see. Now, this year's event happening on Friday is going to happen at the Art and Psychology Building on the Valparaiso University campus. Tell us, Michelle, a little bit more about the event and the fact that there's actually going to be not only soup bowls on display for the silent auction, but actually some soup involved.
I've been really fortunate. We go through at least probably 5-6 crock pots of all sorts of delicious foods, some of them vegan, some vegetarian, some meat or fish, just depends, and then cornbread. So people really enjoy that while they're kind of fighting with each other to get the highest bid. And you can also throw a pot in the mm-hmm. potting room. I have my students there to help guide you in making a little pot if you want.
for some people, it's probably been a long time since they've done that. If they're not a potter or they don't seem to have the skill, maybe the last time they did that was something maybe even in kindergarten or first grade. Might have done something with clay then, and then here's their chance to put their skills, although now as an adult, back to work, I imagine. And I also understand, too, that there's going to be an interesting raffle that's going to be offered as well, too, during the event on Friday.
That is new as of last year, and we weren't sure how it would work. It was a great success.
Yeah.
One of the teachers, last year it was Sarah Jancy, she did a beautiful drawing of a couple who won the raffle. So we're repeating that, and I think it's a great thing to have.
Tell us more about Abby Bodine and how she's involved in offering up the raffle prize this year.
Well, at our faculty meeting, I asked around who would like to do it, and everyone kind of looked at Abby.
It's your turn this year to do it, I suppose. That's great.
Yes, and she very kindly said she would be happy to do it. She's the graphics design teacher, so I have no idea what will come of it, whether it will be a drawing or she'll go into the graphic arts and do some manipulation, and we'll just have to see. She'll get the chance to decide that.
Well, it'll certainly be a great way to close out the day. We're talking about the annual Soup Bowls for the Hungry fundraiser that's going to happen, put on by the Valparaiso University Art Department. It's going to happen Friday the 23rd, starting at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and it's going to be held in the Art Psychology Building on the Valparaiso University campus. And if you have more questions, you can go on to the Valparaiso University website and find out more, or just show up at the Art Psychology Building at 4 o'clock on Friday and enjoy some soup and see some very creative soup bowls and maybe even make one yourself if you're so inclined. And Michelle Carrazzo, thank you very much for talking about this, and hope you have another great year with the annual Soup Bowls for the Hungry and all of this going to help an organization that is going to help other people out in the community as well, too. Thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you very much.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for being with us. Back with you on Monday.